It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a look at a new proposal for universal background checks on firearms purchased in Wisconsin.
But first, it's time for Food Friday, and we have a very special treat this week. Chris Kimball from America's Test Kitchen is with us.
He's here to help us with some kitchen shortcuts and to share some of his favorite recipes. We also have a special gift if you make a pledge of $10 a month or more, a subscription to Cook's Illustrated Magazine. Make that pledge at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. The magazine has lots of recipes, kitchen tips, vetted by the team at America's Test Kitchen.
And we'd love to hear from you on this one. Do you have questions about cooking? Any particular questions for Chris Kimball? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Chris Kimball joins us now. He is host of America's Test Kitchen's television and radio shows. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's jump into some of your kitchen shortcuts. The first one is about thawing meat quickly. Now, this is one that catches a lot of people off guard. They get home, they're hungry, but the meat is frozen. What can we do?
Well, if you plan ahead, and I never do, you can leave it in the refrigerator for a long period of time, and that's safe because you don't want the meat to get, especially chicken and poultry, over 40 degrees for a long period of time. But we did come up with a new method, which is you put the chops, the chicken breast, the fillets, whatever, in a Ziploc bag in a bowl of 140-degree water, which is you can get right out of your tap. And that will thaw in somewhere between 8 and 12 minutes, which is incredibly fast. And it's not sitting at a unsafe temperature for very long. So it brings it right up to temperature that thaws it. The other thing you can do, which takes more like in 30 minutes to an hour, you can put thin cuts on a cast iron pan at room temperature or an aluminum pan. And they're such conductors of heat that the cold essentially gets sucked out of the meat and It brings it up to temperature. But 140 degrees, 8 to 12 minutes in a Ziploc bag is really the way to go.
Chris, when I'm in a jam like that, I often defrost in the microwave, and it always seems really gross and kind of wrong. Is it gross and wrong to do that?
It's gross and wrong, yeah. Maybe that would be a good cookbook. Gross and wrong. The problem with microwaves is you're not going to get even thawing. Defrosting, and that's I've done that. That just doesn't work out too well. I mean, the best thing to do is just leave it in the refrigerator overnight, but nobody's that thinks that far ahead, so the warm water technique's pretty good.
Well, another tip that you have involves decanting red wine, and this is for people who are really serious about their wine, who aren't just going to cork and drink. And I guess the science is that you want to let red wine breathe, but you don't want to wait forever for it. What advice do you have?
Well, I would argue with you, and I agreed with you till about 2 months ago. I thought this was for, aficionados, but I did a blind tasting between wine that was properly oxidized versus just opening, and it's a huge, it's like twice as good. It's not like 5% better. It's night and day. And the reason is when you open a bottle of wine, the neck's very narrow. So you're not getting much oxygen, and you just think about the very top of the wine. The surface area is very small. So there's almost no oxidization going on, and therefore the tannins, et cetera, aren't becoming mellow. So the two things we did, one was pretty extreme. We put the bottle of red wine into a blender, electric blender, and nailed it for about 30 seconds. And that actually did a good job. But the better thing was to take two glass decanters, just bottles, right, or pitchers, whatever, pour it back and forth 12 times and aggressively just pour it in. And then the wine has oxidized. And it's not a small difference. It's the difference between enjoying your glass of wine and not, because most red wine, especially a big wine with lots of tannins, is virtually undrinkable once at the moment you open the bottle. And just letting a glass of wine sit in the counter for 10 or 15 minutes isn't going to do much either.
And the blender's not going to impress the guests, right? It's going to freak them out a little.
It impressed my guests. They went like, whoa, really? What are you doing? It's like, it's a good party trick. So that actually did a good job, but just back and forth 12 times. Some people think decanting is about making sure that the lees of the stuff from the bottom of the bottle, rest and stuff. But the fact of the matter is that that's for wines that were produced very differently and were aged. That's really not a problem now. You just want to get oxidization going oxidation going, excuse me, to get the tannins and other compounds to mellow out.
A related topic, you put something to the test that I think was bartender lore, lime and lemon juices. Some people had said that you should let lemon or lime juices sit a while before you make mixed drinks with them. This is a topic of great personal interest to me. What did you find out when you put that to the test?
Well, we did a margarita recipe 8 years ago, and we let the crushed slices of lime sit with some sugar for a number of hours. And that produced really, really great drink and a nicer flavor. So we got interested in this and did some tests. It turns out that there are terpenes, a chemical in citrus, not oranges, but in lemons and limes. And you really want to let that stuff sit around, and they oxidize, and you get a much better, more mellow, more complex flavor, just like a red wine, what we just talked about. And 4 hours is good, up to 6 hours, and you're still in good shape. It doesn't work for orange juice, which does start to turn bitter when it gets oxidized. But lemons and limes, it makes a huge difference, and that's why if you're going to make drinks with this, it's better to juice it ahead of time and let it sit.
Well, I want to move to another one, which is, I think, something that everyone has tried at one time or another. Everyone's probably failed at one time or another. That's making popcorn on the stovetop. Sometimes you know it's done because you smell burnt smoke and see it setting off your fire.
Me. The smoke alarm goes off and I know the popcorn's ready.
Right. So how do we avoid the burnt kernels?
Well, you know, sometimes in cooking, it's about imperfection. I would say burnt kernels is sort of, for me, because that's how I grew up, is making imperfect popcorn is part of the fun. But if you want it perfect, take a few unpopped kernels and put it in the oil as the oil's heating. And the beauty of that is you want to get the oil to about 380 degrees. So when they start popping, it's an audible reminder that the oil's at the right temperature. So that's the first thing you do. You take the pan off the heat, add the rest of the kernels, and cover the pan, wait 30 seconds. Then put it back on the stovetop to finish cooking. And that way you end up getting all the kernels heated at the same time so that they pop almost simultaneously. So it's a simple trick, but if you don't like imperfection in your popcorn, that's the way to go.
Chris, I'm a butter and salt guy. What do you put on your popcorn?
Butter and salt.
Oh,
I mean, but
the classic.
Well, the only I have to say something about popcorn. I once worked for a guy a long time ago who ate nothing but popcorn all day.
What?
He was on a popcorn diet. Yeah, he didn't put anything on it. This is his way to lose weight. Oh.
So he was in great shape, huh?
And so for 4 years, every day, there was vast quantities of popcorn going through the office. So I'm at the point where I kind of like I can't do it anymore. So I'm going to have to wait a few more years before I go back into the world of popcorn.
Can I just add one more topping, which you overlooked, I think, Rob? Brewer's yeast. I think it's fantastic.
I used to do that all the time.
Popcorn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had that. That's actually quite good. My daughter actually was just experimenting with caramel sauce on her popcorn. I think it was about the caramel sauce, not the popcorn. But
we're talking to Chris Kimball, host of the America's Test Kitchen TV and radio shows.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Chris Kimball is with us. He's host of the America's Test Kitchen television and radio shows.
And we're taking your calls on this. Do you have questions about cooking to ask the nation's leading expert on the science of cooking? Do you have any kitchen tips that you'd like to share with us? You can call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Chris, I want to talk a little bit about what America's Test Kitchen does and what Cooks Illustrated does. Now, this is really about good food, number one, but it's also about the science of cooking. You know, you don't really say marinara sauce is tasty, so here's a recipe we think is pretty good. You actually go to work and try to figure out how to make the perfect marinara sauce, right?
Well, yeah, what we're trying to do is to figure out what you're going to do with our recipes when you take them home. It's sort of like what my kids are going to do after they get out of college, you know? And so we want the recipes to be foolproof. So in order to do that, we need to understand what makes them work, what makes them fail, and then communicate that to the reader or the viewer as well. So you understand, you know, if you use cake flour instead of all-purpose flour, vice versa, this isn't going to work or it is going to work. So the science isn't just because we like science. It's to really understand why a recipe works and how it works so we can say, you know, here are the things you really got to watch out for because this will change the results substantially.
You can get lots more of that kind of information with your own subscription to Cooks Illustrated with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Pledge $10 a month or more and ask for your subscription there. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joe with us in Prairie du Chien. Hi there, Joe.
Hi. I'm curious, are there any rules of thumb for using spices? I like thyme, oregano, dill, rosemary, garlic, all these things, and I tend to just put them all in every dish. And I assume there's basically some sort of following of general rules for, you know, poultry, fish, vegetables, etc. What's your suggestions, Chris?
Sure. Well, there's a few rules. The more delicate herbs are usually better off being added right at the end. And you can also balance out a dish, a soup, a sauce, a stew, by adding things at the end to get the flavors right, including garlic or ginger or herbs. Spices are best bloomed at the beginning of a recipe in oil, because most spices are oil soluble. So that's why a lot of curries, for example, you might cook some onions in oil, then add spices, and for 5 or 6 minutes you cook them, and you can see the colors change, and you can start to smell it, and that'll bloom the flavors. Some herbs are good at longer cooking, like rosemary, for example. Some are best, as I said, basil, something very parsley, cilantro, something very light at the end. The last thing is, I very often will take a whole, branch of something, essentially, and put it in instead of mincing leaves or pulling leaves off. I find that unnecessarily fussy. So I'll just put in some stems of things and then fish them out at the end. but in terms of selecting which, I mean, there's certain, you can't go wrong with thyme. There's some sort of basic things. When you get into more particular flavors, don't just add everything. I'd be very careful. I think less is more. Stick with one or two things. Try it, and then you can always add as you go along, as you cook, but don't put too many things in. You know, it's sort of like Middle Eastern cooking is about individual flavors. I think that's the best way of thinking about it. So if you're going to use dill, you don't need cilantro.
All right. Well, thanks, Joe. I hope that answers your question there. And we have a question here from Teresa in Trempealeau County wondering if you can make potato dumplings with box potatoes. What do you think about that?
No, I don't think that's going to work out too well. I mean, I remember back in the 70s, I actually did occasionally make, or I worked with someone who made them out of a box, but that's good for camping. I mean, if you're up in Montana on a riding a horse, that's really good for dinner. No, you definitely would need, the thing is you need the starch and the potato and the right kind of potato, and you have to leaven it properly. And so, no, I mean, mashed potato, sure.
Chris, you sent us some recipes. We've got a couple of them up on the Central Time Facebook page. One of them I'm really eager to use is for asparagus. We're eagerly awaiting for the end of winter and our first big veggie, asparagus, to come along. Can you give us some tips from your lab on what to do with our asparagus when we got it?
You can either broil them, oil them, put them on a heavy baking sheet, and shove them under a broiler about 4 inches from the heating element, 8 to 10 minutes. You can do the same thing in two layers in a large skillet and put that in a very hot, like 450 oven. That'll also do the same thing. About halfway through, you'd want to mix, turn them over, mix them up a little bit. But you can get some good char in an oven, much like you would on the grill. But the high heat is a key thing. High heat really brings out the flavor of asparagus.
And what about texture? Do you still want it to have a little bite to it?
You do, but, you got to be careful. This al dente thing, I mean, if you talk to an Italian, I just had dinner with someone locally who actually grew up in Naples, and she said the same thing, that Americans went crazy with al dente. I mean, you don't want to have to chew it, I mean, it should be cooked, but a little bit of bite is good. But I know at a lot of restaurants, you get the stalk of broccoli, for example. Or green beans that are basically uncooked.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
I mean, real Italians would say, you got to cook your vegetables. So cook them, but just leave a little bit of bite, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, let's take one more very quick call. Tiffany joins us from Amherst. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What about your question?
Good. Well, my daughter and I, we've been baking for quite a few years. I mean, she's only 12, so You know, but she's been helping me, and we bake a lot of, you know, cookies and cakes and cupcakes and all, you know, from scratch, and we use semi-high quality ingredients, and we've noticed recently that we'll make these great cookies, cupcakes, whatever, and we'll be eating them, and they're deliciously wonderful, and then all of a sudden we'll get this really sour spot, and it just sort of comes out from nowhere, and we'll be like, ooh, what was
That's
that?
Not what you want in your cupcake. So a sour spot, Chris, let's talk about sour spots in bakery.
It sounds to me like you got a little bit of baking soda or baking powder that was not fully dissolved in the batter, and that's usually what's going on, because baking soda in particular, I mean, baking powder is baking soda with a couple other ingredients. It is very sour. It has that sourness to it. So it may be that it wasn't fully incorporated. Sometimes it's good to let a batter sit for a few minutes so it hydrates, so that the ingredients really do get in touch with the water, so they really dissolve thoroughly. But it may be that you're, and especially with muffins and cupcakes, it always says, you know, don't overmix. And some recipes will actually say till that you just see a little bit of streaks of flour. So you have to be careful that the chemical leavener is actually fully absorbed by the batter.
That's a mistake I've made. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Pleasure.
That's Chris Kimball. He's host of the America's Test Kitchen television and radio shows. Remember, you can get lots more great advice with your pledge of $10 a month or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Ask for your subscription to Cooks Illustrated when you make that pledge, $10 a month or more.
Coming up next, we'll talk about a new effort to require universal background checks on gun purchases in Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.